Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacy Toth of PaleoParents.com and author of two paleo cookbooks, the first, Eat Like Dinosaur, kid-friendly gluten-free recipe and guidebook, and Beyond Bacon, recipes that respect the whole hog.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne, also known as the Paleo Mom. I have a background in medical research, and I love to write approachable explanations of the whys behind the paleo diet. I'm also the author of two upcoming books, The Paleo Approach, which is a complete guide to managing autoimmune disease using diet and lifestyle, and the companion guide, The Paleo Approach Cookbook.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up, and you get to listen to our gossip. So, welcome to the Paleo View again, Mr. Russ Crandall. How are you?
Hi, how's it going? I'm good.
Good. I know Sarah's with us as well, but I'm really kind of excited.
I'm like so the afterthought on this show. Russ! And, oh yeah, hi Sarah. That's okay. I'll be the afterthought.
We've been chit-chatting a little bit before the show started. I think, you know, for our viewers that might not know this, Russ and I live relatively close together, and I consider Russ a good friend of the family and love that we have things in common that we can kind of vent to each other about and bounce ideas off of in the community. So we have kind of a unique relationship. Our families like to bond that way. So I feel like I have my bud on the podcast. And also, we don't very often have men on the show, so that's like double exciting.
Sweet.
But so you're, for those people who don't know, Russ is the domestic man, thedomesticman.com, and he has a brand new book that just came out this week, The Ancestral Table. And for those people that don't know, what's really interesting about what Russ does is, although it's not strict paleo, he has a flair for international flavors and recreation of traditional recipes. That is something really unique to the community. And I have personally tasted many of his recipes, and I can tell you that they're all delicious, especially when he cooks them himself.
Thanks.
Super excited that you can share this book with the rest of the world and they can experience your awesomeness. And I know Sarah feels the same way because you met Russ when you came up for the Beyond Bacon release party.
And instantly fell in love. I have a total crush on Russ. So it's just one of those things like, sorry, not, see, I can hear him blushing. I'm sorry, Russ.
I am.
You know, I got to meet Russ and I was like, instantly like, I want to be this guy's friend. Like it's, and then you fed me your food. And then then we cooked together and pretty much, you know, it's been roses and sunshine ever since.
Russ also has a wonderful wife.
And I am happily married as well.
Yeah. So we adore your wife, Janie, and your son, Oliver, tremendously. Ollie and the boys love to play together. So, anyway, so welcome to our home away from home, Russ, the Paleo View. Why don't you, for what we haven't already mentioned, kind of give people a little bit of an overview about you? I think, like many of the people within the community, you have a pretty compelling success story, so to speak. And you have an interesting journey that got you to where you are and what you ended up ultimately calling kind of your personal version of paleo, or what Chris Kresser would call, you know, your personal paleo code, what Paul Gemine calls the perfect health diet. I think it's most of our listeners follow much more strict paleo, either from necessity or from kind of recommendation from the perspective of, you know, an autoimmune protocol and that sort of thing. So I think it'll be really interesting to delve into how you also have an autoimmune condition and how you're kind of managing that with medicine and with food and lifestyle, and then, you know, how you've come to a much healthier place in your journey over the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Okay. Well, that's a tall order, first of all. But so the biggest thing with me is that I was totally normal guy up until I was about 24, 25, and then I had a stroke out of nowhere. I lost all function on my, or all fine, motor function on my left side. So I'm left-handed, so I like had to learn how to write again, you know, and how to walk and that kind of stuff. So you can imagine at 24, that was kind of crazy. And then a year later, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition called Takayasu's arteritis, which causes inflammation of the arteries. And for me in particular, it caused it in the pulmonary arteries. So I would get short of breath really, really quickly because I wasn't getting enough blood to my lungs and vice versa. So I did, let's say, almost 5 years of heavy immunosuppressant therapy, you know, typical steroids and immunosuppressants, that kind of thing. I did an open heart surgery where they tried to reconstruct my pulmonary artery and it didn't work. And so I was basically at wit's end, and I, you know, kind of had just resolved to the fact that, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to be like this forever. And then one day, you know, it was probably a month or two after Rob Wolf's book came out in 2010, I heard about the book and I read it instantly and changed my diet instantly. And within weeks, I was feeling better, back to normal almost. And then since then, it's been about 3 years now, I've slowly been able to wean off of every single medication except for one. So but I've done a lot of tinkering over the years, you know, and I found what works best for me is a very kind of traditional diet, and then I still eat rice and potatoes, a little bit of dairy, you know, just for flavor and that kind of thing. And I've kind of found what works for me, and for me that works. That's really kind of it.
No big deal.
Yeah. I mean, so the big thing with the and you talked about the perfect health diet and that kind of stuff was, you know, three or 4 weeks into paleo, I was feeling great, but I hit a wall. I just wasn't having enough energy. It didn't matter how much fat I was eating. I just didn't feel like I was getting enough to get through the day. And so I said, well, you know, I'm going to try a little bit of this whole carbohydrate thing again. Because you can imagine in 2010, paleo at that time was very kind of low carb, you know, other than sweet potatoes and plantains. People were like, oh, no, stay away from fruits and all these kind of things. But I started again with white rice, just a little bit at a time. And it basically just fixed all of those problems I was having. And I just kind of tweaked it from there. So now we eat usually once a day I'll eat carbohydrates. So either with lunch or with dinner. And usually not much. I'd say a half a pound, which sounds like a lot, but in terms of carbs, a half a pound of potatoes, usually just, you know, one solid potato. Rice is half a pound is you know, a good handful of rice. It's not that much, really.
That's probably, you know, we should probably talk about how the paleo community as a whole has sort of evolved over the last few years to embrace carbohydrates a lot more than, as you mentioned, the paleo diet was 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Because now we have this whole concept of safe starches. We've had the great potato debate of 2012, and now we, you know, anybody who's been a part of that understands that potatoes are generally, you know, fairly well embraced by the majority of the paleo community. And rice is starting to become one of those foods, you know, I think in large part thanks to Paul Jaminet's work and the Perfect Health Diet, it's becoming recognized more and more as a food that, you know, can be a really good food for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in large part, this is recognizing the importance that carbohydrates actually have in our body chemistry. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was one of those very interesting things. When I was writing my book, I had come in from having used some sort of GAPS, really, really low starch type strategies personally. And it sort of, I had found that it helped. And then I had been playing with incorporating more starchy vegetables. And I really wanted to understand, you know, for me, it was really important to come up with a set of recommendations that I could back up with scientific studies. And I was really trying to understand starchy vegetables versus fruit and the impact on the gut bacteria, as mm-hmm. well as the impact on things like blood sugar regulation and, you know, cortisol and thyroid hormone. And as I was doing my research, I really came up to the, you know, the conclusion that especially in autoimmune disease, because the thyroid is often affected in autoimmune disease, even if it's not the target of the autoimmune disease, because of the crazy hormone dysregulation that happens, mm-hmm. that especially in autoimmune disease, being a little bit higher carbohydrate can actually help protect the thyroid gland, which then protects, you know, sex hormones, and all of these hormones also interact with the immune system, and it can be actually better to be including starchy carbohydrates. And so, you know, for me, that was a real, that was a lot of research that really had me sort of come around and pull back from recommendations that were more similar to GAPS diet or specific carbohydrate diet, where you're going super low starch to starve the gut bacteria. And yeah. I really, when I scoured the literature, discovered that all of the evidence for those strategies is anecdotal. And there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that they work really well for 2 or 3 weeks to treat overgrowth. Mm-hmm. And then you have the opposite problem. You have undergrowth. And you can potentially get a therapeutic effect. But over the long term, there was all of these problems that could be cropping up with low thyroid function, with cortisol dysregulation or cortisol receptor dysregulation. You can even have problems with leptin sensitivity from being too low carbohydrate. And it's one thing for an elite athlete to play with a ketogenic diet versus a higher carbohydrate diet and experiment on themselves. When you're looking at immune regulation, mm-hmm. It seems to be, you know, there's always going to be exceptions, but it seems like a better starting place is to start with the inclusion of starchy carbohydrates. Rice is interesting because it's fairly low allergy in terms of, I mean, it is a grain.
Yeah.
But it can actually, there are proteins in it that can cross-react with gluten. So my recommendations are usually like stay away from potatoes because they're nightshades and rice, but embracing all of these other carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the paleo community as a whole and you look at healthy people, it kind of makes more sense to me to be including potatoes and rice. I made rice for supper tonight for my family. I don't do well with rice. It gives me horrible stomach aches. I don't eat it. But my kids love it, and I make it with bone broth. So they're getting probably more broth than they would with just about anything else that I would make when they yep. eat rice. And I've actually really noticed that my husband and my kids are all, they have much more even energy, including them. And Stacey, I know you've had a really similar experience with adding starches into your diet.
Yeah. For me, you know, I definitely came from the super low carb paleo mindset, you know, kind of the first 2 years I was paleo, similar to Russ and everyone else. That was all that was on the market at the time. And then, you know, I had a health crisis that culminated from a lot of the things that you were talking about, a lot of the hormonal dysregulation, adrenals, thyroid, my autoimmune flare. There's just like a kaboom of problems. And I really strongly feel that that was because I personally was not eating enough carbohydrate for my own body. And even more so than that, I don't have a gallbladder. And I believe also that not having enough carbohydrate was contributing to my body's inability to properly digest the nutrients that I was consuming because I didn't have a gallbladder to properly process the high fat and protein diet that I was eating. And so as I started training in 2013, when I started CrossFit, about the same time that you were kind of doing your research for the paleo approach and talking to me about, you know, relaxing on the carbs and eating more vegetable and not being afraid of starch and that sort of thing, I really allowed myself to eat more starch, and I didn't do potatoes or rice because I was doing an autoimmune protocol. And I made sure, especially I found in the evenings, that starch helped my cortisol be regulated and helped me sleep. So I had, you know, kind of the portions, Russ, that you're talking about of starch. Mostly mine were done in the evenings, maybe not quite as much as you. I try to stick to like, you know, around 100, depending on if I've been active or non-active that day. It can be, mm-hmm. you know, plus or minus 50 points. But for the most part, I find that that works, you know, well for me to just maintain. And then when I started really training heavily in the last 6 months, and in addition to that, had really done a lot of healing and recovering from an autoimmune condition and the flare that I had, you know, I found that I'm completely tolerating high quality dairy, which is something I've never been able to do. I mean, it started with my ability to eat heavy cream, you know, like not eat obviously, but like a tablespoon in my coffee was something that didn't bother me. And I kind of expanded that to, all right, well, let's put whipped cream on berries. Can I handle that? And then it turned into, okay, well, let me try this raw cheese while I'm out at a restaurant. And I find that I have absolutely no problem with high quality dairy. Even grass-fed ice cream doesn't affect me anymore, which is awesome. And I think a lot of that has to do with really healing my system. And so once I realized I could do dairy, I got really excited about the idea of adding in rice. And part of that was Russ's influence, because Russ makes a lot of really amazing food that I see both on like his, you know, from his personal life as well as on his blog. And there were a lot of recipes that he was talking about doing, and I was like, oh my gosh, I want to eat that. And it wasn't that long ago that I kind of messaged him jokingly about the fact that Matt had made risotto and it was amazing. And I thought of him when I was eating it, because it would, there's no way I would have gotten to a point where I would have thought I could eat risotto if I hadn't kind of had that influence. And, we eat rice cooked in broth. And, I mean, especially if people tolerate that and they tolerate butter, there's a really high nutrient content in broth cooked, and rice cooked in broth and then topped with butter. Like you're getting the collagen, you're getting, you know, all kinds of minerals and stuff there. So I just don't think that, you know, if it's something people tolerate that they should be worried about. And I think that the work of Chris Kresser and Paul Jaminet and, you know, even Matt Lalonde and Rob Wolf's coming around to this now, like a lot of people are recognizing it. This is something you tolerate. If you're not sick from this food, like Sarah said, she doesn't tolerate it, then don't eat it. You know,
right.
But if you do, especially for me personally, like I am training. I mean, I'm still not comfortable calling myself an athlete, but that's what I am, right? I train for 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. And my body, I can tell a difference, huge difference in my recovery time if I have carbohydrate after I work out. And whether or not that's anecdotal, I don't really care, because I'm listening to my body and my body responds and performs better the next day if I've had carbohydrate after I work out. I also happen to work out in the evenings, and so that carbohydrate also helps me, I believe, regulate my hormones and stuff by kind of helping my cortisol and sleeping through the night and that sort of thing. So it's not something I have every day. I think Russ described it as a couple times a week. That's probably the same for me. We definitely have rice probably a couple of times a week, mostly in the form of sushi. Our new favorite thing is Saturday after we all the boys CrossFit and I strongman, there's a place that's local to us that has gluten-free soy sauce. They have like tamari, and they have a sushi buffet, and they know us really well, and they make sure that there are rolls and sashimi on the bar that don't have either soy sauce, tempura, or crab. And everything, there's so like half of the buffet they make sure that we can eat. And that's like our favorite thing to do is Sushi Saturday. It's like our new family activity. And I feel great after. I don't feel, you know, bloated. I don't feel uncomfortable. My joints don't hurt. I don't have anything that would indicate to me that the rice is a problem. So I think it's, you know, it's interesting. Because a year ago or 2 years ago, I probably wouldn't have reacted that way to it. You know, it's been a journey of healing, and it's also because I'm, you know, regulating my blood sugar through being physically active. And if I were a couch potato and not moving, I would not probably be able to consume that amount of rice and not, you know, put on weight or whatever from it. But I think it's interesting to me because Russ is a very lean man, you know, and so for Russ to be kind of the face of rice, potatoes, and dairy are okay, it's an interesting perspective, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Did that answer? Yeah. It was a rambly.
No, that was great. Yeah, you know, honestly, thinking back about it now, you know, the other part of it was that I was losing a lot of weight on the low carb kind of thing, more weight than I wanted, and it made me feel really weak. And adding in those carbs brought back, you know, the 5-10 pounds that I was missing. And being a lean guy, you know, I'm always trying to gain a little weight, and so the carbs have really helped to regulate my weight as well, which has been good. It's weird for a guy to talk about that, but I think being too skinny. So
no, I think that's important. It's not just about liking being too skinny. Like, you look very healthy, and I can imagine if you were 10 pounds leaner that it would get to a point where you would feel like you didn't have enough stamina or energy.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And that's the beauty about eating the right kind of diet, is that everybody's body should regulate to what works for them. And for some people, you know, you don't want to lose any more weight. And for other people, you don't want to gain weight. And for me, you just don't want to think about weight and you want to focus on strength. Right. It's different for everybody.
Totally.
I'm still thinking about the sushi.
Yeah. I'm sorry that rice doesn't work for you, because I've honestly gotten to a point where, like, sushi is my, like, the thing that I look forward to. I love it. And risotto. Although I've only done risotto like 3 or 4 times in like a 6-month period. But every time I have it, I'm like, oh, why don't we do this more often?
It's not like I've got the foods that I just will not touch because I will be inflamed for months, like nightshades, or, you know, gluten. Rice just gives me a stomach ache. Like, my body just doesn't know what to do with it. It's kind of like, it's one of those, you know, when you look at something and you really want it, you know, you're not going to feel very well, and you kind of make an educated choice whether or not you're going to do it. I could do that with rice. It's, with the exception of sushi, though, I've never found, like, rice has never been a food that I loved. It's a great vessel for raw fish, but I would be just as happy to eat the raw fish with some vegetables and seaweed anyways.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, it's not a food that I feel like I'm missing out on anything. And I certainly can't claim that for that many starchy, wonderful things. But it's always been a sort of food that for me is the filler that you put the flavor on top of. And that actually makes me want to really emphasize something about the ancestral table, because it's really sort of a paleo plus rice type cookbook. And it really is sort of more perfect health diet rather than what would be typically considered strict paleo. But you have a recipe in here for cauliflower rice. And you could, at any point, any of the recipes in the rest of your book where you call for rice, you could substitute cauliflower rice for those recipes and make those recipes completely compliant with a strict paleo diet.
There's also the conversion. Yeah, there's the conversion chart in the back too for all the recipes that include dairy and rice and that sort of thing.
Potatoes, yeah.
Yeah, it's called a substitution guide.
Yeah, so in that guide, I didn't go as far as to say that they're all Whole30 compliant, because for the most part, I did not take out substitutions for sweeteners. So there's a little bit of honey in a lot of recipes and stuff like that, as well as alcohol. So I use wine a lot in cooking.
I think saying a little bit of honey in a lot of recipes is an exaggeration, Russ. I've never seen a paleo book so clean, to me, clean ingredients from that perspective as your book. And I think that I want to make that very clear to people. One of the things that I really like about it is that it is so focused on savory flavors, which is really unique. And, you know, I think that it's really respectful what you've done to focus on food that way. You focused on the nourishing part of food, which is really wonderful.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, for me, it was really big to not put any sort of like shortcuts or cheats or anything like that in there. For me, it's every single dish is something that I can stand behind and say, yeah, this is a typical paleo dish, you know? So I just did a count while you were talking, and there's 18 recipes that have honey in them, but most of those are probably about 1 teaspoon to 1 tablespoon per recipe. And that's usually to offset the bitterness of aminos or tamari and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so just
that's not a particularly high percentage.
It's not.
That's like
at all.
Under 20%. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's 112 recipes, so yeah, it's still very low. Definitely.
Yeah, so there's only like a handful of things on this list too that you say cannot be adjusted. You know, it's right. like most of the things, unless you're using potato starch, which you use as a flour sometimes, is yeah. pretty much the only thing that I see, you know, in here that adjustments can't be made for completely clean paleo.
Right.
And I know from testing the recipes that I was still doing autoimmune protocol when we tested recipes for you, and I had absolutely no problem finding more than enough recipes to test. In fact, I remember I gave Matt the list and he was like, seriously, we're not busy enough. How many recipes did you sign up for? Because I was like, and this, and this, and this.
Yeah, so I sat down, this was, a week or two ago, looking through Sarah's website as well as Mickey Trescott's website to try to get a guide of exactly the autoimmune protocol and stuff and how I would be able to adjust my recipes for that. And I haven't published it yet, but I think it's 48 out of the 112 recipes are autoimmune friendly, autoimmune protocol friendly, or else can be easily adjusted. Right.
Yeah, that was actually, you know, for me, I was not expecting to see I was expecting to see so many recipes I wanted to make because I want to make like every single one, but I wasn't expecting to see so many recipes that I felt really confident, like, you know, oh, well, I just, you know, I'll substitute coconut aminos for tamari soy sauce here and then poof, done.
Yeah.
And so it's, I also have to say, it's just so beautiful. It's just, you know, I mean, I wasn't expecting anything else knowing your style and your eye for art and food photography and your perfectionism. but it really is, I don't want to say the most beautiful cookbook because I know Stacey would be like, hey, but Beyond Bacon. But how about Tide for the most beautiful paleo cookbook? Can I say that, Stacey?
Yeah. I told Matt when we were writing our review last night, and he was writing up the pork adobo thing, and I was like, just go ahead and say that we should be ashamed of ourselves for calling anything that we did good pork after eating recipes. He was like, I cannot say that our pork is not good, Stacey Rebecca. He called me by my middle name. And he was like, I'll say something nice. And I was like, okay. But I think that's what makes, you know, kind of proves that something's really good is like, I have no problem putting my ego aside and saying like, Russ did a fantastic job with the recipes and the pictures. And I feel confident saying if people liked Beyond Bacon and the kind of recipes that, you know, I like to think that there were quite a few traditional recipes in Beyond Bacon as well. Mm-hmm. In a different kind of traditional sense, right? Like we didn't have the same kind of international flair that Russ has, but we tried to evoke the same sense of traditional ways to make food, that the way your grandmother would have made it and not shortcut and not those kind of things. And really paying attention to the quality of the food that we were creating and using the cuts of food to the maximum flavor potential. Like if that's something that you really enjoyed about Beyond Bacon, you're going to really love The Ancestral Table because it's a different take on the same kind of thing.
Yeah. Thanks guys.
Well, yeah. And I think we all have very similar palates too. So I think that, you know, if people know that they like, you know, my recipes or if Stacey like your recipes, then they can feel pretty confident that they've got a palate that's really well suited for Russ's recipes. Because I think that we all have sort of a fairly similar approach to balancing flavors. Although I think Russ takes that to a far more sophisticated level than I do. Your cooking just is like the international Julia Child of paleo.
Oh, you need to capture that one, Russ. Put that somewhere.
you can quote that.
The international Julia Child of paleo.
Like beyond French cuisine, but that approach of, you know, the real ingredients and the real flavors, and that you really do get, you know, so many more different layers of flavor when you do these slower cooking techniques and when you really take your time. And you know, I think that's something that's lost, not just in actually I think paleo cooking is probably bringing that back in a lot of ways because we're so used to now cooking things from scratch and not buying pre-packaged foods. But it's something that's definitely lost in sort of society as a whole, is that sense of, you know, having something cook all day or for 2 or 3 days. And that's something that, you know, we see more because, you know, I routinely make bone broth and it takes 2 or 3 days to make. But you bring that to the main dish, I think, in a way that we haven't seen in a paleo cookbook yet.
Thanks. Yeah, you know, one of the things that I thought about when I was writing the book was really a lot of paleo books will make recipes of dishes that taste like another dish. But my idea was, well, let's just make that dish. You know what I mean? Let's actually go for it. No shortcuts. And we're going to just approach it the way that someone would have done that, you know, 50 years ago, you know, however they've done it in history and stuff. And so that was a big, really important thing for me. And I thought, well, this might turn off some people, you know, who are looking for a lot of 20-minute meals. But at the same time, if they really want to replace those dishes that they'd eat at restaurants, or, you know, they've eaten growing up or something like that from their grandparents, I wanted to kind of replicate that idea. And I did throw in a lot of 20-minute dishes in there too. So it's kind of a good mixture of both, I think.
Yeah, I need you to make me the Southern fried chicken.
We just made that over the weekend. It was really good. We've actually been cooking, now that we actually have the physical copy of the book, like, we have been cooking out of it nonstop. Like, so for tonight,
isn't that so fun to, like, use your own book and not have to go to the internet to look up your recipe?
Exactly. Yeah. So we cooked
Little known fact: bloggers actually use their own recipes.
Oh, yeah. It was one of the main reasons why I wanted a book, was just to have a book. But so I made barbecue ribs and meaty collard greens. Both of them are in the book, and we had that for dinner tonight.
I've had both of those recipes. I had the ribs at your house at the picnic that we had outside.
Yeah.
And you brought the meaty collard greens to our house for a potluck, and it was so delicious that I insisted that we needed to test the recipe.
I was there for the meaty collard greens. I was there for them.
Wasn't that delicious?
It was ridiculous. And I mean, so much so that I've made them at home. And it's like, I get super excited when I get ham hocks, because I'm like, woohoo, meaty collard greens. And, you know, like, and I play with it, but, like, it's in my normal rotation now. And it was all because of that, like, wonderfulness. That's like, just for our listeners' sake, we are talking about a side dish that I ate last July.
Yeah.
And it still has this impact on me. It was that good. Who remembers what they ate last July, really? And normally the side dish is not the star. And, you know, really from that meal, the things that stood out was Russ's meaty collards and Matt's asparagus.
Yeah.
I have to admit that Matt's asparagus also imprinted.
Did he grill it or roast it?
He grilled it in lard with salt and pepper, and that was it.
Yeah.
And it was like,
I told him he needed to put that recipe. I told him that he needed to put that recipe in the next cookbook, and he insisted to me that that was too simple. He's like, I am ashamed to put a recipe in a cookbook that has, like, salt and pepper as two of the four ingredients.
Okay, so Matt, I know you're listening because you listen every week when you produce the show. Matt, put it in a cookbook. It is like the awesomest asparagus ever.
There you go. Sarah says we have to.
Nice.
Not to jump back, but one of the things that I wasn't done talking about with carbohydrates that I think it's also a really good tie-in for talking about the book is that another thing that I've noticed about when I consume starchy carbohydrates is that my body is not drawn to sweets, which has been a really interesting thing for me to learn, because I always thought that, you know, one carb begets the next carb, and that I would be, you know, drawn to an overabundance of, you know, refined carbohydrates if I ate starchy carbohydrates. But it's had the opposite effect on me. In that, you know, maybe I'll want some berries after dinner, but for the most part, like, if I'm properly eating the right amount of carbohydrates for my body during the day, I don't seem to get that, like, post-dinner, I need carbohydrate, I need sugary, you know, deliciousness.
That's really interesting.
Like, something's missing or
yeah.
something.
And, you know, I don't know if that's like a glycogen thing. I don't know if that's an emotional eating thing. I don't know, you know, particularly what it is, but it's fascinating to me. And I think, you know, it's your style, but it also speaks to the fact that you probably, you don't have much of a sweet tooth either. I know because I personally know you, that your book doesn't reflect that either. I mean, there are a few sweets in here, but none of them are overly sweet. Most of them are actually nourishing foods, like they have gelatin in them, or they're made from bananas, or, you know, your hazelnut cake is not overly sweet. I tested that myself. I can tell you it's worth making, everybody. but, you know, I think, and I don't know, Sarah and Russ, kind of what your take on this is, but it has been a fascinating experience for me that, you know, I had your pad see ew for dinner. Mm-hmm. And it's made with sweet potato noodles. And normally I would want something after dinner. Like either it's a piece of dark chocolate or it's a couple of berries. And I no longer want something overly sweet, which is something I've always had my entire life. And it's like a mental thing. Like I have to tell myself, no, you don't want that. Mm-hmm. But when I had, like, for example, for dinner tonight, like, I have absolutely no interest in anything other than tea. Like, I'm going to have a glass of tea when we're done with the podcast. And, like, that's what I want and look forward to rather than, you know, thinking about, oh, how can I justify a dark chocolate frozen banana? You know, like, it's right. An interesting thing for me. And I wonder, have you always not had a sweet tooth? Have, like, Janie has a little bit...
Yeah,
less of a non-sweet tooth than you, but she's not like a huge sweet person either. You know,
right.
I wonder how much of that is adequate carb consumption. You know,
so I think that's you're touching on a big part of my platform. I talk about it in the front of the book a little bit too. Is and while I'm kind of defending the rice and potatoes thing in the I have a whole chapter on it in the book. But basically, my idea is that you know a healthy diet is not only one that's healthy foods, but one that's sustainable. So the idea that if you know, you're cheating or that you know, fall off the bandwagon every once in a while because you can't maintain your diet, then that's not a good sign. So for me, the key to me, to the way I eat is that I try to hit all of those reward centers with the foods that I eat. So, so that I have no cravings or anything like that other than the foods that I make. And that's worked for me over the years. I definitely, you know, I could put away a whole thing of Krispy Kremes, you know, back in the day, or I could, you know, Halloween candy and that kind of thing. I could sit there and eat it for hours, you know, and make myself
Halloween
sick.
Candy. I used to stockpile it so that I would have it for months after, like not just one a day for months afterwards, but like pounds a day for months afterwards. But you know, I was also nearly 300 pounds, so yeah. That might just have something to do with it.
So I would say, yeah, definitely the carb thing I think has been able to mitigate a lot of those cravings and stuff like that. You know, just we as a whole family, even Oliver and stuff, we just don't gravitate towards to sweets at all. You know, we even have them in the house, and even trashy Halloween candy from last Halloween is sitting in the house, and you know it remains uneaten. You know, and I think that's a really good sign for us.
What do you think about that, Sarah? I heard you say interesting as I was talking.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess like I can think of a lot of possible explanations, but I can't. I mean, I can't say for sure. I don't know if there is sort of a known mechanism that would tie in, but I can sort of think that things like more even blood sugar throughout the day would do that, and especially because more even blood sugar throughout the day would also help regulate cortisol, and dysregulated cortisol is one of those like culprits in evening sugar cravings. And it would also be really good for thyroid health. So, I know that's one of those things that people have sort of heard, like, why do you need more carbohydrates for thyroid? What you need for thyroid health is actually really well-regulated blood sugar. So high blood sugar, is not good. So if your blood sugars are swinging high after meals, that's not good for your thyroid, but you actually do need insulin for conversion from, thyroid prohormone T4 to the active hormone T3. And so So you need to have some carbs in order to have that conversion, and you need to have, you know, the T3 is many, many, many times more active than T4. These thyroid hormones control metabolism. They control your sex hormones. There's a really, really strong link with the stress response. So you want your thyroid to be in that happy medium range. And one of the ways you can get into that happy medium range, you know, there's things like sleep and have fun and, you know, eat a nutrient-dense anti-inflammatory diet. Make sure you're getting the nutrients that your body needs to make thyroid hormone, like iodine and selenium and zinc and iron. But another huge piece to that puzzle is eating enough carbs to support thyroid function without having high blood sugars, which would then suppress thyroid function. And that, you know, where that range is may be different for different people, but it makes sense to me that having the, because starchy carbs are a slower burn. So they enter your bloodstream a little bit more slowly, and they tend to keep blood sugar a little bit more regulated than if you were getting your carbohydrates more from fruit or from, you know, like a paleo treat or something like that. Like, so, you know, to me, I think about all those hormones, and I think about how, you know, eating more starchy carbs during the day would impact all of those. Stacey, you also mentioned, like, half an hour ago, that you were finding that you were sleeping better by having more carbohydrates in the evening. And there are studies that show that there's sort of like an optimal window for a large carbohydrate heavy meal around 5 hours before you go to bed, sort of 4 to 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And that a carbohydrate dense, and they mean like a starchy, slow burn carbohydrate dense meal. And they don't mean all, they mean all macronutrients, but getting the majority of your day's carbs at supper can dramatically improve sleep quality. So it'll actually be easier for you to fall asleep. You'll get into the slow wave deep sleep more quickly. You'll spend more time there. You'll get your REM sleep in the morning, and you get like really, really healthy sleep patterns. And so, you know, I'm sure that there's, you know, a whole pile of really interesting, you know, hormonal chemistry going on. And there's probably stuff that's going on that I don't even know about. Like, it's such a complex system, and it's a system that I understand really well from an immune health perspective, but not necessarily from a metabolic health perspective, because that's not my area of expertise at the moment anyways. Maybe someday I'll decide to learn more about it. You know, I think that that's just a really interesting, you know, tie-in to everything else that you've been doing to get, you know, to be an athlete like you are now, like super healthy and awesome. So, you know, so yeah, I was just, you know, like for me, it's you know, thinking about how all of those pieces of the puzzle are fitting together, and I can't quite see, you know, all of the pieces, but I think it's really, really cool. I'm a nerd that way.
All right. Moving on from carbohydrates. What was your favorite dish to create? Not your favorite food that you like to eat in the bush book, because I actually already know that question. But what was your favorite dish to kind of invent and experiment with? And can you tell us the story of it?
Oh, man. That is such a tough question. the most fun dish for me to actually make and to cook for, like, other people and stuff is the first seafood recipe in the book, which is salt-crusted fish. And for me, I love this dish because it's so dead simple. And especially here in America, where people are kind of averse to seafood and fish in particular, especially if it's a whole fish. No one knows what to do with a whole fish unless you just, you know, wrap it up in some tin foil, throw it on the grill or something. You know what I mean?
That's what I do with whole fish.
So in this recipe, I wanted to really kind of do something that was a little bit, you know, against the grain, but also kind of yeah, but also kind of fun to work with. So you can salt crust anything. So some people make a salt crusted chicken and they cook it like that. But in this dish, basically all you do is you take a bunch of sea salt, which you can buy like at a I bought ours at an Asian market for like $10 for 10 pounds of salt, and it's coarse ground sea salt, kind of like what you would throw on the roads kind of thing. And so what you do with that is you mix it with egg whites, and then you just cover a fish with it. So you make this big mountain, and then you throw it in the oven for 25 minutes. And that's it. You just come out, and it comes out, and it makes this shell. And so you take it out of the oven, you let it cool for a few minutes, and then you crack it open with a spoon and just kind of lift the whole shell off. And you've got this perfectly roasted fish inside that isn't salty, and it's just pretty awesome. So I love doing that for, like, guests, you know, because you just take this huge mountain of salt out of the oven and all of a sudden you've got this roasted fish underneath. It's really kind of fun. And everyone just picks at it, you know, and eats it together. It's kind of fun.
I know they serve that traditionally at a Thai restaurant that we go to. Do you know where the kind of original idea of that cooking method comes from?
So what I found was in Sicily. It was a big dish. So it's called pesce al sal. I'm probably saying it wrong because I don't speak Italian at all. But yeah, it's a, I believe it's a Sicilian tradition.
One of the things that I really love about your book, but that even more so the boys love about your book, is that when they were going through reading about the recipes, like, for example, Wes and Matt were cooking tonight, and Cole pulled up the book and read it out loud for everybody, because Finn was like, "Where's this recipe from?" when we told them it was your recipe. And I think that's, it's fascinating that, like, my six-year-old, well, my almost six-year-old, knows that you have a taste for international food. And, like, when I told them that it was your book, Finn was like, "Where's this recipe from?" And Cole was like, "It's definitely Korean, because Rush is, like, part Korean or something." And I was like, no, he's not part Korean. He just likes Korean food. I'm like, let's read about the dish and read, like, where it came from. And so there's a really neat write-up on almost all the recipes about, because you have this traditional international flair, you know, where your research led you to find the information about the source of the recipe and a little bit of information about it, which is, for a six-year-old and an eight-year-old boy, kind of the coolest thing ever, you know? Like, and also for grown-ups, like, I'm interested, you know, I was curious where the dish was from, because after Cole said it was Korean, Finn was arguing that it was definitely Japanese because it was noodles. So it's good for them to see that it's actually Chinese inspired.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that's, and it's funny with that one, and I forgot to write it in the book, but so pad see ew is the same as, you know what char siu is? You ever seen that? It's like that red pork. It's the same siu. It just means like roasted. It's just spelt differently because the Thai is the one that adopted it. Anyway, I could talk all day about history. But so, yeah, my bachelor's degree was in history. And so I've always kind of been a historian, you know, at least by inclination. And so I wanted to add anything that I didn't know ahead of time about a recipe. I started kind of compiling it all together and making a history or fun facts or anything like that. Things that I found interesting about the dish and kind of brought it a little more personal to me, you know. And so instead of just saying, "Oh, I like this dish because I used to eat it when I lived in France" or something like that.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with things like that.
I shouldn't knock that stuff. But for me, it felt a little bit inauthentic, you know, just in that I was like, I have to write 112 like personal, you know, memories of these dishes. Like, maybe I'll just go with a global history. And so that's kind of when I went with, and I've been doing that on the blog for years too. It's just kind of really fun to do that.
Yeah. It's definitely consistent with your style, which I love. I love when bloggers that I follow, and I follow their blog for a reason, write books that are consistent with their aesthetic. There have been some books that have come out in the last year or two with paleo because paleo is popular and, you know, people just write the books the publishers want them to write rather than writing the book that they themselves would want to write. And it's, you know, sometimes evident in the book that you're reading. And I definitely got a sense of authenticity from your book, that it very much is you and matches and mirrors what people will find on your blog. Which Thanks. Is thedomesticman.com.
Yeah, that was a big thing for me too. I was a little worried when I sent the manuscript off. I'm like, oh man, they're going to make so many changes to this. And really, other than, you know, typos and grammatical errors and stuff like that, they really left left it all up to me, and I was really happy with that. So
yeah, Victory Belt's really good about that. Sarah and I can both agree there. It's a wonderful publisher who kind of trusts the authors, and you know.
Right. Yeah, totally. I'm really happy with how it turned out.
All right, Sarah, you got a tough question to ask.
A tough question to ask. Do I have any question to ask?
I mean, go for it, obviously.
Okay, well, here's my selfish question. Can I ask my selfish question?
Sure.
Where do you get sweet potato noodles?
Amazon.
Yeah, you can get them on Amazon, or just for us, Baltimore, Washington area, the metropolitan area is like the fourth largest Korean population in the United States. So there are a ton of Korean markets, and it's Korean noodle, and so for us, it's super easy.
And
$2 for a bag.
What are the sort of standard ingredients in it? Like, what is it just sweet potato, or is it
just sweet potato starch, or else it'll either say sweet potatoes or sweet potato starch and water. That's it.
That's it? It's not even held together with egg?
It's so good, Sarah.
Nope.
Well, I'm going to be shopping on Amazon in about 10 minutes when we're done this podcast.
And Monica
will
put a link in the
show
notes.
It won't ever come because we're going to get hit with the biggest ice storm in 40 years tonight.
Like, we bought a 4-pack of them on Amazon, and like one of the packs is like a box of pasta. It's huge. It like, we had leftovers and my kids never stop eating. And I have never heard the words out of my kids' mouths before that I heard this evening when we gave them a giant pot of sweet potato noodles. Before their food was gone off their plate, they were like, "We're full." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, carbohydrates are the most amazing thing in the world."
Are they sort of like a rice noodle texture?
Yes. Yeah. They're much better than kelp noodles, in my opinion.
Yeah.
They have more of like a like, you know, when you used to eat pad thai and eat rice noodles, but it had like a slight flavor.
Yes.
That's kind of what they are.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really yummy.
Yeah. I think you'd love them.
They're really good.
I haven't had them before.
The only thing about them is that they, depending on who the manufacturer is, the noodles are very, very long.
Yes.
So I tell people in the book, cut it to 6-inch lengths. But even then, they're really hard to cut, like when they're raw. So we have like kitchen shears, and I have to cut them no more than like 3 noodles at a time, because anything more than that, I can't even get through them. It's pretty funny.
Wow. That sounds like fun.
Yeah, the kids were trying to eat them tonight, and like they tried it, because they don't never have pasta either, right? Like it's not. I don't even think they've had like a real noodle like that in 3 or 4 years. Wesley's never had noodles like that, you know? So he's like trying to, I was teaching them like the fork twisty technique, and they'd start twisting, 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 and the whole plate full of noodles was like coming up. And they were like, it's like Lady of the Tramp, you know? And it was definitely like a fun eating experience. So
yeah, we do like, we do vegetable noodles in my house relatively. I mean, at least once every weeks I'll do. I really like making kohlrabi noodles. They hold together really, really well. And I just cut it with a vegetable spiraler, and they, you know, it's actually probably my favorite vegetable to spiral cut for noodles. And then my kids will do the whole like slurping it, you know, slowly, and they have lots of fun with that. Mm-hmm. But I kind of think that this would be, I think I would be very popular if I made this. So I think I will try and get an Amazon order in before we lose power.
Sweet.
Yeah. So. And then it'll just be waiting for me when the city thaws.
All right. So if that's your selfish question, I want to thank Russ for coming on the Paleo View. And unless you have additional things that you'd like to share, I do want to tell people that you can catch more of Russ, Sarah, and I on a little mini East Coast Paleo book signing tour that we're going to be kicking off probably by the time this podcast goes live. We'll have information up, so we'll link to it if it's live. But I know that Sarah has a book launch later in February that's by herself in Georgia, but then she's going to be traveling north up the East Coast for us to do DC, Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Isn't there one other city?
No, that was it.
Okay.
Just those two.
Sarah and I are going to do New York City, probably as well. And so, and perhaps even more. So at the very least, if you're in remote vicinity of DC and Philadelphia, make sure to set aside those dates because we'll make it worth your while with all three of us there. And that's a potential of four books to get signed. And
yeah,
book signings is always a really, really good thing to do for gifts as well. So, you know, even if you have your own copy or whatever, I always recommend to people just, I mean, personalizing a book and getting it signed for something is a special gift to receive, I think. Like, oh, you really were thinking of me.
Yeah, I agree.
Cool.
Yeah, I honestly, let me see if I can add anything. So I am doing a couple book signings on my own in mid-March. I'm going to do New York City, Rhode Island, and Boston. And then I'm hoping to do lots of other stuff, you know, during Paleo Effects, you know, I'll definitely be there. So I'll have all sorts of signings.
Yeah, but then, I'll be there too.
Yeah, after that, I'm hoping to do something really fun too and get to the West Coast this summer too. So hopefully there's hope that you'll be able to see me. It'll be kind of fun.
I'll be on the West Coast this summer too.
Yes. See, we're all over the place.
I might be able to make it to the West Coast, I hope. Summer is just not a good time for my job, so it depends on, you know, when and how long and
right.
all that jazz. But I think the Ancestral Health Symposium is in San Francisco, so
yeah.
if I can kind of double up on those kinds of activities and see more people, it's worth my while.
Sure. Well, thanks, guys, for having me on. It was a lot of fun. It's a nice, relaxed conversation.
And I cannot wait to see you this weekend, Russ. I always have fun when you stay with us. So
thanks.
We will see you Saturday at
yeah.
Red Apron in DC. Everybody should go who possibly can. Even though there's a snowstorm coming, it will definitely be over by Saturday. So everybody can get their big boy britches on and head on out to DC where Russ is generously providing free, amazing, delicious food through Red Apron, which is where, we held our Beyond Beacon book release party, although we did it at a different location. Russ chose the larger one after experiencing the cramped space of my party. I already called ahead and asked them to bag me a bunch of their pork rinds because they're so delicious.
I am nice. So missing out this weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome. They're closing down the restaurant at 8, and so we get it from 8 to 10 just ourselves, so it's going to be really fun.
Sounds like so much fun, but I get to play with you guys in a month.
Yes.
That's true. That is very true.
I will take you by Red Apron and get you pork rinds if I need to, Sarah.
I believe you do need to. Like the best pork rinds I've ever had. Anybody who lives anywhere near there, find Red Apron and get their pork rinds because yeah, so meaty collards, asparagus, and Red Apron pork rinds, and apparently I didn't eat enough starchy carbs this summer. And then just to, like, while we're talking about book signings, I am doing one local event in the Atlanta, Georgia area at my local Whole Foods, the one that I actually normally shop at. It's Whole Foods Merchants Walk. It's in Marietta. And you can get information about exactly where that is, the time. It's February 23rd from 1 till 3 in the afternoon. And RSVP on my site, there's links at thepaleomom.com/events. So you can go there and you can actually see everything that I've got going on. I'm going to San Francisco in May, and I'm working on some other West Coast stuff. Well, I happen to be on the West Coast for my brother's wedding this summer, so I'll probably be in the Vancouver, Seattle area in July. So as I firm up those dates, that'll all be on that site. So good one for people to bookmark.
Cool. Sweet.
Well, it's great to talk to you both. I look forward to hanging out with each of you and both of you in the near future. And for our listeners, if you're jealous about hanging out, we've just given you plenty of opportunities to join us. So thank you, Russ, so much for being on our show. And,
yeah, thanks for having me.
Giving us an opportunity to talk a little bit about the great carbohydrate debate, which Sarah and I have been hesitant to do for a while, but I feel very confident after the health improvements that I've seen over the last year and the gains that I've made with strength and performance to be able to say clearly it's working for me. So that's not to say that it works for everybody, but I do think it's important for some people to hear that who might potentially have a need for it. So there you have it, folks. We eat carbohydrates and we live to tell the tale. That's not to say we're eating 500 grams of carbohydrates, however. So be mindful of choosing the right ones in the right proportion for mm-hmm. your body. So, wow, that was like a little carbohydrate infomercial there.
That was good.
If only we could just sell carbohydrates.
Like in pill form. Here you go. Like,
I mean, I guess we can. It's pretty easy to sell carbohydrates.
Well, evidently.
But, like,
we should just become sweet potato noodle resellers and then we're good to go.
There you go. I will report back on my sweet potato noodle stories in a future podcast episode, I'm sure.
Perfect. All right. Have a good one, everyone.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal. Why? How come I have two copies of this book and I cannot find a single copy anywhere?
You good, sir?
I'm good. I'm not distracted at all. Not at all.
Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, you snap out of it.